The psyche is the world's greatest pivot. Not only is it the one great condition for the existence of the world at all, very Buddhist, that statement, it is also an intervention in the existing natural order. It is an intervention in the existing natural order. This is what we do with our practice. We intervene in the untrained mind. We intervene in the conditions of the mind, the conditioned habits of mind. We intervene so that our psyche that has been imprisoned in its potential, has been somewhat defined by the various traumas and woundings and even its successes, we do an intervention through awareness that we can through our mindfulness and intention, we can really make a difference on how we what we notice in the world and how we interpret it and how we relate to it. And this is one way of understanding the teachings of the five aggregates. So, as I mentioned earlier, when we start to relate to life through our practice, there becomes a sense of realness. We can feel more real to ourselves. And for some people, it's the first time in their life they have felt real to themselves. Very understand that. And we start to have choice. We start to have choice. A poem to read you. I'm going to read you a series of poems through the weekend. This is from Tony Hoagland. He's a modern poet. And it's from his book, What Narcissism Means to Me. Maybe I overdid it when I called my father an enemy of humanity. That might have been a little strongly put, a slight over-exaggeration, an immoderate description of the person who at that moment, 2,000 miles away, holding the telephone receiver 6 inches from his ear, must have regretted paying for my therapy. What I meant was that my father was an enemy of my humanity. And what I meant behind that was that my father was split into two people. One of them living deep inside of me like a bad king or an incurable disease, blighting my crops, striking down my herds, poisoning my wells. The other standing in a time zone in a kitchen in Wyoming with bad knees and white hair sprouting from his ears. I don't want to scream forever. I don't want to live without proportion, like some kind of infection from the past. So I have to remember the second father, the one whose TV dinner is getting cold while he holds the phone in his left hand and stares blankly out the window, where just now the sun is going down and the last fingertips of sunlight are withdrawing from the hills they once touched like a child. So we all have a comedian inside us. Everyone in the room looks old enough to have discovered this, that there's not a single entity in there. There's this whole committee that we tend to think of as me and myself. And this committee is made up of widely varying views and attitudes and perceptions. And depending on the moment and the conditions of that moment, various committee members are in charge. And sometimes these committee members create little cabals where they rule the roost for a while and then it shifts and so forth. And so we all have either a father figure or a mother figure or an archetypal figures and a wounding person or persons from our childhood inside us. And indeed, those figures can blight our crops, you know, poison our wells, and strike down our herds. Part of what we learn to do is to be with our experience in such a way that those inner figures don't get to rule the roost. So that the emotional chaos that those inner figures feel, experience, manifest, do not get to control the situation. Even though those inner figures may not go away our entire lifetime. But the emotional chaos that we tend to identify inside, internally, we start to have choice about, so that we are not forever a scream. We're not forever living without proportion. That there is a kind of movement in our lives. And that's what emotional chaos is so much about. And tomorrow I'm going to go into more specifics around the book than I'm going to do for the most part today. But just to mention some chapters that I would have you be aware of in one form or another is in particular chapter 2 of Getting to Know the Real You, which is talking about identity and how we have mistaken identity. And I refer to it as the myth of fingerprints, that we get confused. We think our history is who we are or our responsibilities, and on. And I take each of these beliefs we have about who we are and explain why that's not so. Not actually a good chapter to start a book with if you want to sell many copies, but nonetheless, if you want to have people have understanding, well worth doing. And then I would also have you notice chapter 7. I see many of you have notes pads, so chapter 7 on starting your day with clarity. I would really encourage every single person to try one of these starting your day with clarity exercises. The book's been out long enough, and I'd already been teaching this. Just such positive response to this. And then I would, about making skillful decisions, I would really have you focus on that chapter. And about the bringing mindfulness to major life changes, I would have you focus on that chapter. Because these are things that you wouldn't necessarily get exposed to with other teachers and teachings. And then the chapter on ending the self-violence, I'd really have you focus on that. So much of that in our society. And then the chapter on overcoming ordinary compulsion. That these are all chapter titles that I'm giving you. And then the chapter on living skillfully with the difficult, which includes dealing with the four kinds of personal defeat, which I hope to get to tomorrow, that we can go through some of that together. So all of these chapters I named are chapters that move us away from those internal figures ruling the roost. They move us to a more wholesome relationship with the psyche, one that is informed by Dharma understanding. So what is in fact chaos? Chaos is this turmoil that is in the world, where the world is happening according to its own set of rules and not as to how we would order it. It is a natural thing. It's not a mistake. Even mistakes themselves are natural. And if you don't think that's true, think of how many mistakes there are. And how could something that is so frequent not be natural? So that it's that we develop from our Western mindsets sometime this idea that we're supposed to be able to prevent mistakes, that we're supposed to be able to stop chaos from happening. How has that turned out? You know? And so we see that it is in all parts of our lives, for looking at it as the first noble truth, there's the chaos of all of the physical aspects of life that are discomforting, scaring to us. It's both for ourselves and others. That there's a lot of dukkha, and that dukkha creates a feeling of chaos. That because of this physical dukkha, we don't know when it's going to occur. We don't know how long it's going to last, and are always vulnerable to the physical conditions of life. Is a chaotic feeling. There's chaos in that. The ego wants to control things. It thinks it's supposed to control things, and yet, of course, it can't in that way. So hard on the ego, thus we should be so sympathetic towards it. And then likewise with the emotions of life. Emotions are so chaotic. They're caused by so many different conditions, external conditions, the way someone is harsh to us, or someone frowns, that's important to us, frowns as we walk by them, and we think that it's about us. Maybe it is, most likely not, but nonetheless, we go into this kind of chaos, you know. And on, to see suffering of people we care about, to see the suffering in the world, to see human mistakes made over and over and over again, the mistakes that we have seen that are so clearly don't work, and yet over and over again, this is one of the pains of aging that is seldom mentioned, but is so painful, is to watch it be passed from generation to generation. These very same mistakes, very painful. So chaotic feeling that what's going on here? And those two together, the physical and the emotional, those would be the first kinds of the when the Buddha talks of the first noble truth about three kinds of dukkha, there's that's the dukkha of the physical and emotional pain, and then there is the dukkha of everything changing, that we can never get anything right. Think of how chaotic that is, that we never get finished with anything. Nothing, you know, your teeth are never clean, they are temporarily clean, disappearing instantly. The good night's sleep is gone. You know, the dishes are never washed. You know, they're always to be washed again. And the burden of this as an experience on the quietude of mind, that there's always something to be done, and there's always going to be something new or different, or it's going to be different in some way. There's no way to set it all up in advance. It's just like, ugh, dukkha. And from our weekend here, the chaos of that. So that's that second kind of dukkha. And then the third kind of dukkha is the dukkha of the five aggregates, that there's even in our moment, when it's a single moment and it's the best moment we can have, we can't find a there in that moment. Where am I in that moment? And it's already gone anyway. Very chaotic feeling. In fact, to the ego, this is probably the most scary other than death itself. I debate back and forth about this, which is the penultimate of those two. Because death itself would be in that second kind of dukkha. The very fact that we're going to die, it creates a chaotic impulse in us. What? You may well remember the first time you discovered death as a small child. And the first, I certainly remember that, and realizing, oh, I too am going to die. I remember very clearly all my feelings around that. Very, very small child, and going off to myself, walking through these kind of bushes more than forest or something, just a group of bushes, and wandering off into there because I really wanted to be with this. Very real to me at a very early age. And so the chaos of that, what does any of this mean if I'm going to die? And of course, that was part of the Buddha's heavenly messengers, three heavenly messengers of old age, sickness, and death. That, well, so how do I relate to all of this? This is chaotic. What? What's the purpose of this if it ends up like this? And of course, that's the value of the fourth heavenly messenger, is when he saw someone who was an ascetic who had wandered forth seeking wisdom, a monk in effect. And so we have this clear teaching in the tradition of this kind of dukkha, this kind of chaos. But we are like this. Life is like this. That's not the kind of chaos that we are going to. When moving to clarity does not mean that we move away from having chaos. That chaos is going to stick around. And also, in many ways, it's interesting. It makes life poignant that we're going to die. I said last night that the difficulty of life is in a way the very inspiration. The dukkha of life is what inspires development. Why would we ever develop the generosity or patience in all of this if we didn't have to do that because of the conditions? You could easily imagine being a spoiled child for eons, you know, and one of the teachings about the realm of the jealous gods. That's how they are. They can have anything they want, but others have more. So we see as that in the second noble truth, which is thirst. It's our relationship. We thirst. We want in relation to the truth of dukkha. We want it to be so that we don't have to experience it. So the first thirst is for all sorts of sensual pleasures, be that we wanted every sense gate to be the way we want it. That's the first thirst. And the second thirst is we want to become what we want to become that we think will bring us happiness. Very attached to that. And then we, abhavana, not wanting to be in those areas that we're uncomfortable in. We don't want to be sitting in that boring meeting. We don't want to be sitting in that doctor's chair. We don't want to have a dentist chair. We don't want to have received that diagnosis from our doctor. We don't want to be in a world that does certain things, where people do certain things to one another. This we don't want to be. And this is the chaos of the reactive mind. And this reactive mind is very, very insidious. We've grown so used to it that oftentimes we don't notice. So we won't notice, I mentioned last night, and even in something like looking for a parking place, how chaotic our mind becomes, and how we start to find happiness in finding that parking space, and we start to judge others, right? These people, they could have parked closer together. Or, you know, I always see that car there. You know, that's a chaotic reaction, you know. And yet it is really affecting us. There's not peace in the mind at that moment. There's not choice. It's all reactivity. And so as we see that there's another way to be, we start to look for a way to live so that we're not defined by that chaos. And in doing that, the very difficulty of life does become our teacher. So the clarity is the clarity around the chaos so that the chaos informs us, invites us to be all we can be without our having to say, I know what I can be. It becomes our way of living to be that which we can be as best we are able. So the orientation is towards living a life based on our values as best we're able to do so, based on what really means something to us, how we aspire to live. And then what actually happens is our karma. But we're changing that karma in every moment. Every moment is new and different because of our very intention and the way we're living. This is a poem by Mary Oliver. It's called Heavy. That time, I thought I could not go any closer to grief without dying. That time, I thought I could not go any closer to grief without dying. I went closer, and I did not die. Surely God had his hand in this, as well as friends. Still, I was bent, and my laughter, as the poet said, was nowhere to be found. Then, said my friend Daniel, brave even among lions, it's not the weight you carry, but how you carry it. It's not the weight you carry, but how you carry it. Books, bricks, grief, it's all in the way you embrace it, balance it, carry it, when you cannot and would not put it down. So I went practicing. Have you noticed? Have you heard the laughter that comes now and again out of my startled mouth? How I linger to admire the things of this world that are kind and maybe also troubled. Roses in the wind, the sea geese on the steep waves, a love to which there is no reply. Choosing to move into a mindful, intentional relationship to the conditions of life, chaotic as though they may be, and in any given moment, potentially becoming more chaotic or less chaotic. But choosing to move into a mindful, intentional relationship as to how we are going to be, whether it's much more chaotic or less chaotic. We have a clarity of aspiration, a clarity of purpose, and an intentionality that is moment to moment, that is immediate, as I was speaking at the very beginning of this, that there's an immediacy as to how we're going to relate. It's what's true right now. I'm relating to looking for the traffic, for the parking space right now. Right now. That's my practice. My practice isn't, I want to be a good yogi. No, it's like, how am I being as I'm looking for this parking space? What's the condition of my mind? What is my heart engaged in as I'm looking for that that parking space? When that person unfairly, by our social contract, zips in and steals our parking space, which is a violation of the social contract, it's wrong. From the view of the social contract, it's not wrong from this being part of human nature. What happens in our heart? What do we do to ourselves? Do we really mean what we're wishing about that person that moment? And do we think that doesn't have any effect, what we wish on people? Do we think that doesn't have any effect on ourselves? Have we not all seen people so bitter that they're eaten up with their bitterness, their cynicism, their disregard? I have seen very successful, very powerful people whose lives I'm grateful to not have to live for a moment. So eaten up with this. And are we any different in our own ways? I would suggest not. May not be so clear to us the way that we're unskillfully relating to the chaos in our lives, But it is there. That's what I would suggest. You get to decide for yourself. So we start to look and say, then what is this clarity? The clarity, as we would understand it from Buddhism, would be the clarity of the Eightfold Path and following the precepts and so forth. From the way I'm doing it in the book, is that that there is a seeing of how we're relating to the moment. Are we relating to the chaos of this moment from a reactive mind or a responsive mind? Very simple. Very simple. A reactive mind is defined by attachment, by clinging, by grasping, by being reactive to the dukkha of the chaos. A responsive mind is a mind that is responding regardless of the conditions from who we would aspire to be in all conditions. A reactive mind has no choice. A responsive mind has a wide range of choice. Thus we see that a reactive mind is a mind that is shaped by the second of the Buddha's four foundations of mindfulness, pleasant and unpleasant, vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant nor unpleasant. That moment to moment, in the untrained mind, it tends to be seeing the world based on whether what's being known is pleasant or unpleasant as it's being perceived, and by the habits that come out of this long conditioning around that particular kind of pleasant or unpleasant. Thus, we become like puppets on a string. Two strings, really. One string is if it's pleasant, oh, I want that. I want that. Oh, I like this. My precious. And so we want to make sure nobody's going to take it from us. We don't want our significant other to change in some way that's... We like this person the way they are. We don't want that change. We don't want them to have that interest that may take them away from us. And we want more. Oh, but you know, my friends admire me. I want them to admire me some more. I like that. Oh, they appreciate how giving I am. I'll make sure they know just how giving I am, so I'll get more of that. You know, it's around things that are even admirable within themselves, if not related to well. You know, we can get into grasping. So it's wonderful that we're giving people. But if we get attached, if we become identified and want to see ourselves as this giving person and want other people to see us as this giving person, then it's a cycle of suffering. Cycle of suffering. So wanting more of. And I certainly don't want anyone to take it from me. So that's that string. And then if it's unpleasant, oh, I want to avoid that. I'll cross the street. I don't want to do that. I'll go flip the TV channel. I don't want to have to be with this feeling. You know, I'll open the refrigerator door. I'll pour myself another drink. So there's at the unpleasant and how we would seek to avoid it, or we would seek to numb ourselves if we have it, or seek to blame someone else, or to totally blame ourselves. And thus, there's all of this chaos, this pleasant and unpleasant, this mind reacting, and getting grooves in the mind so that it becomes more and more automatic, and there's less and less choice. There's even less awareness of it. And oftentimes, not only is at that level, but we've already then judged ourselves for how we respond to pleasant and unpleasant in each circumstance. So now we've got it. We've now made a judgment about it, which we then either condemned ourselves or we're defending ourselves. And then we've reacted to all of that so that we're all layered up. And it becomes, as the Buddha says in various suttas, a tangle. A tangle. He means it literally, as far as I can tell, that it is a tangle. The mind-heart becomes a tangle, a complete tangle. That's chaotic, huh? That's really chaotic. And so we see that there's another way of dancing with life, That's not the way a puppet dances on the string. And that is through the responsive mind. In the responsive mind, same experience of things are pleasant. We appreciate they're pleasant. It's fine to wish to have more pleasant, but there's not that sense of attachment in the same way. We have an intention to be what matters to us so that we don't get seduced by the idea of pleasantness. This in the chain of dependent origination, which we're not going into this weekend. That would be a whole weekend exploration in itself. There's one of the key moments in that is after there arises pleasant from contact, there arises this, there's this contact, and then there's this Vedana feeling, and it's either pleasant or unpleasant. And then there's a kind of desire arises. And when I'm talking about that with students, I like to stress the idealization, because people can get to thinking that you're supposed to kill desire, that a good Buddhist wouldn't desire anything. And maybe that's true, but would you really not desire for your children to be safe? Would you not really desire for your friends to get healthy? Ajahn Sumedho says that desire is the natural energy of this realm, and that's the way I hold it. But the idealization around desire is challenging. Because we believe in the unconscious mind, we believe if we weren't in this unpleasant condition right now, we'd be so happy forever. If we just had this, we'd be so happy forever. We're not saying it in those words as adults, although as children we did. And you can watch children do that, where they think they've got to have this, and once they get it, they lose interest in it. We don't lose that tendency of mind. We just become more skillful in how we're living it out. So in the responsive mind, we're not seduced by the idealization. We don't fall for that. We have trained ourselves in such a way that we don't believe it. And we don't believe it because we choose to see what actually happens. And we see over and over again that it does not bring what is promised, that it is a misperception. We could call it a false promise of the reactive mind. It's just not true. There's always wanting more. Or even if we get it and we really like it, then it changes. It goes away again. That it's not that the idealization of it, the idea of some fixity, is where the problem is. It's not that it's not truly pleasant. It might be what we want that we perceive to be pleasant may be true. But even something that's pleasant, after a certain amount of it, okay, enough already. And the unpleasant, if it's not this unpleasant, there'll be another one, you know. Or the unpleasant, it turns out, once we cease resisting it, maybe it's not all that unpleasant. And it may turn out to be that this is the least of the possible unpleasantness, and that we're better off with this particular unpleasantness than another. It's much more, one would take a bit more skepticism in terms of our view, not trusting our view so much. And so then we start to see that if we want to have a responsive mind, a couple of things are necessary. And this is what I spend the first part of the Dancing with Life, with Emotional Cast of Clarity, establishing these two characteristics that are so necessary, these two skill sets that are so necessary to have a wise relationship, a kind relationship with chaos in our lives. And one of those is mindfulness, samasati, the mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. And the other is samasamkhapa, wise or right intention. So the Eightfold Path starts with wise understanding. You wouldn't be here if you didn't have some level of understanding of your condition. None of us would be here. if we didn't understand this. So there's everything starts in terms of changing our lives with some degree of understanding. It can be very conscious or not conscious, very intellectual or just more animal-like, but there's some degree of understanding. And then it completes. The fruit of the practice is this this realization of that understanding as a manifested state of being, the end of the whole journey. And then after wise understanding comes wise intention. And wise intention is where the rubber meets the road. You know plenty of things that you don't take advantage of. I mean, we know not to open that refrigerator after 10 o'clock at night. We know that we're never going to find satisfaction flipping those channels. We know that going through the web one more time is not going to brain us very much. That there's no reason to check our email every 30 minutes, whatever your particular thing is. There's no reason to call that friend of yours who's going to put you down one more time, right? In some way convey to you how inadequate you are as a friend or a person or a spouse, whatever she or he tends to do to you. And yet we do it. We do these things over and over again. So why? Why does this happen? Why don't we live at the level of our understanding? It is in part because we do not have sufficient intention in this moment to overcome the habits of mind, to overcome this reactivity of mind. So we do it anyway. We go unconscious. So there's this absolute immediate intention in this moment. To me, the Buddha's entire teaching doesn't work if intention isn't moment to moment. As opposed to goals, which I'll come to in a second, it's immediate here and now, because the Buddha tells us there is only this moment, that we're not here in any future moment. There's a new set of conditions that's here, new karma moment manifesting. 5 minutes ago, you weren't here. The only time you can make a difference in your life is when you're here. That makes sense, right? And that moment is every single moment. It's right now, because then it's gone again. Right now and right now and right now. This at first can seem frightening or overwhelming, but it turns out to be so comforting as we come to really understand it. And so it is intention that gets us over the hump of our habits, that gets us over the hump of the seduction of getting the pleasant and keeping the pleasant or avoiding or getting rid of the unpleasant. It's that intention that's immediate that allows us to overcome that. And then from that there's right speech, right action, and right livelihood, the living of our lives. And then supporting all of this is right effort, moving the mind in ways that's skillful. Not willing to, when it's not that we are unwilling to be with any experience, we're willing to be with all experience, but moving the mind just how we're relating to that experience in a way that's skillful. And then right mindfulness, wise mindfulness, samasati, and then finally samadhi, the right concentration. Samasati, the mindfulness of the Buddha, is a particular kind of mindfulness, as I understand it. The Buddha says, I teach only suffering and the end of suffering. The Eightfold Path is a path of one end, the end of suffering. It requires the recognition of suffering, or you wouldn't bother to end it. You wouldn't know when it's there or not there. So the suffering and the end of suffering, that is intellectually, again, he's so brilliant in terms of his naming and seeing clearly and all. So when I talk about these two skills being critical for moving from chaos to having clarity around the chaos, that the two skills are that of intention, the way the Buddha taught it, and mindfulness. So this kind of mindfulness, as compared to secular mindfulness can be being mindful of the moment for any purpose. Any purpose. If you're more mindful, you're more likely to achieve your purpose. The thief who breaks into your apartment or your house and steals your computer off your dining room table when you're asleep in the bedroom is being very mindful. Very mindful. They have to be mindful of the sounds they're making, mindfulness of anything they could trip over. Being very mindful. They're very alert. So they're mindful of their steps, they're mindful of their sounds, they're mindful of what is possibly valuable. But that's not the mindfulness of the Buddha. Indeed, a company when it creates employees that are more mindful, that can be in terms of being more mindful in ways that would see opportunity. But that opportunity might not mean the end of suffering. Could be mindfulness of how we treat one another in our company, being mindful of what creates creativity and what doesn't. Depends on how it's utilized in that company. But it's in of itself, it's not samasati. It can be used that way, but it's not inherent that way. So, when I talk about this as a tool, it is seeing mindfulness in such a way that we're able to see the suffering of the chaos and see what is a wise relationship to it, so that there's clarity as to what is the relationship. This is kind of the fundamental here. And again, it's about our daily lives. I've described all of this now in terms of the Four Noble Truths. And yet it's about our daily lives. So we don't have to reconstruct the whole structure of the Four Noble Truths if we just respond to our lives with this orientation of suffering and non-suffering. Then it sort of constructs itself and the very living it out in this way. So these two things are the ones that we will be exploring primarily today as we go throughout the day. Deepening our understanding of them, and then starting to see how some of them show up in some of the ways that I describe in the book. So I'd like to... one more thing before we stop there. So this is... a poem that I think captures... this new relationship to our experience in daily life that I'm pointing to, not perfectly captures, but points in the direction. And it's by Derek Walcott, and it's called Love After Love. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door. Isn't that a wonderful image? The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, "Sit here, eat." You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your image from the mirror. Sit, feast on your life. We do not have to be stuck in a reactive relationship to the inner chaos that happens to us. We don't. We don't have to be stuck. Doesn't mean we're going to be totally free either. But we don't have to be as stuck as we are. There is this feeling of this greeting yourself with a smile. Sharon Salzberg tells this wonderful story. Sharon and Joseph were my early teachers in this practice. And Sharon tells this wonderful story on herself about having done loving kindness on an extended retreat. And she felt like she wasn't getting anywhere, that it was not a good retreat. And she was practicing mostly in her room at IMS and over again doing this loving kindness with herself as the recipient, and it just not really taking hold. And then she gets word that a friend has been taken to the hospital, so she's got to leave there in a hurry and go attend to this friend. And as she's doing so, she knocks something off and breaks it. And she, to her surprise, says out loud to herself, "Sharon, you're such a klutz, and I love you." That feeling is really possible. Last night, and I will at some point in this retreat, I ask people to let loose of judging, comparing, and fixing mind. There is a core relationship that we can have towards ourselves and others that is free of that judging and comparing. Still discernment, still seeing what's skillful and unskillful, what is wholesome and unwholesome as a goal. But free of this judging and comparing that makes us so small and petty and really not such good company in our own minds.